The chant that we've been using, Yud Hei Shin Vav Hei, is a chant that absolutely comes out of the Renaissance. So you don't find it really in Kabbalistic tradition before that. And it's a chant that is about the divine human being. Because in a sense, the letter Yud represents fire, but it also represents will. The first letter He is about water, but represents the imagination.
Sorry, could you start that again?
Certainly. The letter Yud, which is the connected to the lion and the archangel Michael, represents will, an intention. And also the element of fire. The letter He is connected to the eagle, connected to the waters and the archangel Gabriel, is related to the imagination. A capacity for vision. The letter Vav is which is connected to Raphael, connected to the winged man, is the element of air, and it's the capacity to enliven, to bring to life, the breath that creates new life. And in a sense, the human nature all the time is that our intention enables the arising of an image or a form, which then becomes alive through the divine breath. And then the final letter He is the which relates to the Archangel Uriel, relates to the winged bull, relates to the element of earth, is the capacity to embody, to make substantial. Now the letter Shin that is at the center of this, so this is a wheel of moving creative process. The letter Shin represents the spirit, represents the deep spirit, the stillness out of which everything arises. So Yud Hei Shin Vav Hei represents the activity of the divine human being who rests in the deep stillness, and from that stillness then enables the creation enables creation.
Accepting creation.
Enables creation. Enables. It's an active. So as you align with this, and as you, it's also called, the name is also called the healing name, because it, as you chant it, it aligns you with the deep human archetype. So as we chant it, as we allow it into our bodies, into our hearts, into our feelings, it's like our system gets aligned with the deep nature of what it is to be a human being. And that is, in a sense, to be the still center of the turning world, to use T.S. Eliot's phrase. To be that fulcrum, that point through which, if you like, the divine grace enters the world and touches the world. To be also the place where the fractured and the broken and the hurt world can be gathered into the center point where it becomes accessible to grace. And can come again into a sense of harmony from discord.
That's really interesting. When we did the chant to go into the sanctuary, on that last breath, what came up for me was one of the most moving things I've seen in one of these wildlife programs, about when a lioness, in the matriarch of the pride, she walked out of the pride into the bush a short way. She was old, and she let out this, and that was her the final defiant sort of breath, embracing breath, death, embracing death.
Lovely.
And then when we came back in, we came back into the chant again, and it brought a breath back into new life.
New life, yes, that's very nice.
So it's really interesting.
No, it is interesting, that, isn't it? That image of the last breath and the new breath, you know, the sort of the letting go, the surrender into death, and then being brought to life by the new breath, something new emerging. That's a very powerful thing.
Earthy, isn't it? I mean, your imagery is really seems very good.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, no, it's part of the birth is one of the major. Reminder of birth, yeah. So I just want to give you an image, which is a blown up tarot card, which is the title of this workshop. This particular workshop is the spinning wheel. So this is the wheel.
Thank you.
So if we look at this image, we see in a sense the four holy living creatures in the corners. When we see this spinning wheel, and you'll see the letters on the upper right hand corner, you've got the letter Yud, left hand corner the first letter He, lower left hand corner the letter Vav, and then the final, then in the right-hand corner, final letter, Vav. Now, in the, you've also got the word Rota, which is Latin for wheel. Which, if you turn it round the other direction, it reads Taro.
Oh, yeah.
So the again, this is part of the kind of design of this particular pack, but it's the idea of the tarot and the tree as a series of wheels of movement, and that this deep process of Yud He Vav He, with the shin is the silent point at the center, and inside it you've got these rather strange images, really, that really represent the alchemical symbols of the four elements. The one at the top is the image of Mercury, which represents the element of air. The one on the right hand side is the alchemical symbol for sulfur, which is fiery. The one on the left hand side is the symbol of alchemical salt, which is earthy. And then you've got the waves representing the alchemical water. So it's a graphic image of the altar we have there, and of the inner structure that we've been looking at. And one of the key images there is the person is the keeper of the Sphinx. So you've got this image of the Sphinx who can ride the wheel. And the Sphinx is one of the ancient images of a human being. You've got this interesting connection with ancient Egypt as well. But what you've also got are these two figures, rather strange figures. We've got a snake, and we've got it's supposed to be an image of the god Anubis, but it kind of looks a slightly demonic kind of figure, and they're quite ambivalent. Both the snake and the Anubis is this opener of the ways, who is a guide of the soul. Snake conventionally is a figure of evil, but they're both ambivalent figures. So in this kind of image, we have really this summed up much of what we're doing this weekend, which is in really looking at this place of what the place of being the human being, of being the living tree of life in the middle of the turning world. And in that case, having to be the person who knows the mystery of the Sphinx. Now, the mystery of the Sphinx in sort of it takes us to the legend of Oedipus, who says, "What's four-legged, two-legged, and three-legged? What is the animal that is that animal?" And he goes, "It's the human, and it's the human being." So that the encoded in this is the image of that the true human being stands in a way working with the cycles of the world, working with ambivalent energies, trusting the center point, and trusting the four great angels that hold the worlds. So just a good visual, you know, it's just a good visual summary in some ways of this idea, really, that you know, really develops in the Renaissance, of being the true human being working with the soul of the world. And in a way, one of these very inward seeming workings, of course, take us into the center of ourselves, into the center of being the true human being, but also into the center of the world soul. So when we stand in that place, we stand at the heart of everything, in our own heart, in our own bodies, but also at the heart of the world. So this is the place, really, where they feel like the human archetype and the archetypal soul of the world meet. And we're not alone in this, because we're held by the four angels, we're held by the deep spirit. And it is our job, in a sense, to be the still point of the turning world, to enable the divine grace, the blessing, to flow through us, but also to allow the pain of the world to enter us so that the blessing can meet it. So it is the place of not turning away from our own pain, from the pain of those around us, to the pain of the world. But by being held by the angels and held by the Spirit, being protected and unshaken in that place, so that we can stand in the midst of disturbance and bring that sense of grace and stillness into the disturbed places in ourselves and the disturbed places of the world. And in that way, we become the living incarnation of the healing name. We become the living name, the name that heals, just by presence, really. And of course, that presence influences our thoughts and words and actions. But it's not to disrespect just that simple act of apparently doing nothing, where you're mediating the inner life. This is the thing that my friend David Spangler would call subtle activism. We're watching Extinction Rebellion, we're watching all kinds of extraordinary things happen at the moment, and they're wonderful to see. And we all will have our own relationship to these things. But what we're looking at here is something that, though intangible, is no less profound and needed. You know, it takes some faith, it takes a bit of trust in the mysterious. But when you stand in that place, when you stand with the angels, when you become the healing name, the world is touched by that, the world is healed by that. And it's the moment where we take our true place, enabling the blessing.
I've noticed, well, we never go into any of these deep meditations with an intent, but as you've brought up things like the extinction rebellion, is it ever appropriate to have an intent to focus on something when you go into this, or is that the wrong approach? Is the idea just to go in and connect, and that is the action that will be sent where it's needed?
Well, no, you can bring in, it's like you can, it's as if you're bringing in a prayer. No, it's you've got to be careful with it, because you can, you know, the because people can get into trouble with doing this by being too formed in it. Like, you know, sort of, for example, if you went in with the intention of making Theresa May kind of declare a climate emergency, right? If you write, I am going to make, you know, I'm going to use the inner energies to do that. Now, that just wouldn't work. You've been creating you're creating an actual act of conflict and trying to. So, however, to bring in that whole, to journey inwards with a sense of not just journeying for yourself, but journeying, bringing the sense of climate emergency or the destruction of the earth or whatever it is we're concerned about. Because what you do as you stand in that place is you offer the issue to the divine and you surrender in that place because it's then what arises out of the stillness that then has to direct. So it's completely fine to bring situations, people even, cares concerned about people, somebody's ill, somebody's in trouble. It's a bit like you hold them in your heart, so you bring them with you into the sanctuary. You bring them with you into the communion. But at a certain point, you have to let go of all that. You can't direct it. You have to let go of it. You have to let go of even the wish to help.
Yeah.
Actually, so that then you're open to what emerges out of the deeper. And then, as that emerges, that embodies in whatever way it does and flows through you into the world.
I'll just say something in relation to the connection with Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah.
One of the key things that's come out of it for me is the concern about the extinction of the human species. Extinction, the rate of extinction of all
species.
Is an issue.
Yeah.
But the rebellion is against the extinction of the human race, of the humanity. And when you think about it, of the divine human being no longer being on the earth, that is such a trauma to consider that could happen.
Yeah, that gives it a wholly different kind of sense, doesn't it, really? No, it's true. And in a way, the whole, you know, what we're looking at this morning is right at the heart of the whole Kabbalistic system. It's to be the living tree. So there's lots of ideas and thoughts and practices, but they're all in the end orientated at helping us become this being, this divine human being, standing at the center of things, meeting, bringing things together, bringing opposites together. That's why the whole structure of the tree really has this sense of an unity that's formed by the bringing opposites together, so that there is so that the creative flow, which involves, of course, death and rebirth and death and new life, beginnings, endings, is so that that it has its, so the coherence of that is not disrupted. Now, in actual fact, as we are present in the world and present to the things we're mostly aware of, is fragmentation, particularly these days, fragmentation, splitting, the inability to hold opposites together. But by being the living being who brings opposites together, you start to, in a sense, from your own being nature, you sound a note of that harmonizes and that invites harmony, invites the meeting of opposites. In a way that is very particularly human, because if we come back to this just apparently simple thing of the opposable thumb, right, that enables us the bringing of, you know, it's a sort of, they have to push against each other. The whole idea of the word human is, well, comes from manas, comes from hand, from the person who can use the hand to create. And at the heart of using the hand to create is that principle of opposites coming together, the opposable thumb. It's a small thing, but actually it's an essential thing. Because by bringing opposites together, you refine, you create. Friction enables movement. But it's how to keep the wheel. It's how to keep the show on the road. How to keep the wheel spinning so that it doesn't fall. It doesn't fall over and crush everything. So it's to keep the wheel spinning in balance, so that the course there is continually life and death. The death is a natural part of life. Awful when it happens to somebody you love, and that too is part of life. It's just, yeah.
Sort of being quite literal.
That's right.
The books.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thinking behind the books?
Oh, that he's used the, that's because he's using the Christian image of the four evangelists. Right, so what you find, and so what you'll find in churches, these are the four living creatures are very ancient Judaic images. They get taken up by the Christian church as images of the four evangelists. So Saint Mark is the lion, Saint Luke is the bull. Or is it Matthew? Is it Matthew?
Luke is the bull.
Luke is the bull. Thank you. I forgot. Saint John is the eagle, and Saint Matthew is the man. So they're holding the Gospels.
It's actually terribly funny looking at the lion, it's quite funny.
He looks like he's studying it quite directly, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Tail up. He's got his tail up. It's more avid than the others. The others are sort of lions really reading his book.
Yeah,
lions really doing it, actually. Everybody else is not so bothered, the eagle.
Lion's not bothered at all.
Well, it's lounging on it.
Yeah. It's
kind of
conjuring.
That's right.
So that was bringing Christian ideas into the tarot then, in this particular edition.
Yes, you find it actually in the Marseille tarot as well. So it's not just this edition that does that, because you find these images of the four holy living creatures are ubiquitous in Christianity, but their deeper meaning gets completely lost, because they're identified as the four evangelists, but you find them everywhere in Christianity. So rather oddly, these extraordinary sort of angelic figures that are. Certainly in the Kabbalah, one of the, you know, some of the most sacred angelic forms appear all right throughout Christianity, but often find them in Orthodox churches, in the different places. But they're in St. John's Church. So you look around, sometimes most older churches will have a depiction of them somewhere.
The lectern is
normally an eagle. Yes, that's right, and it's
the invisible eagle. Because it's lectern. But don't they start their stars? Is it Taurus and what's it, Scorpio and Leo?
Scorpio for the Leo and Aquarius. Yeah, that's right.
You know when they were talking about taken up by Christianity is
early on. Oh, very early on, very, very early on. I think, but you know, you find depictions of them in the. Well, you see, they're very. I mean, what you have to remember is that Christianity arises out of first century Judaism, and the holy living creatures that come out that you find in the Bible originally in the book of Ezekiel. That's where you first find them. Are very central to kind of Judaic tradition. So the beginnings of Christianity begins as a sect of Judaism. So they would have viewed, and actually, if you look at some of the, this is a little diversion, but it's an interesting one. If you look at the earliest Christian churches in Jerusalem that come from the tradition of St. James, they are always those early churches are always underground. They're reached by a flight of steps going down into the earth. Well, I like the sanctuary meditation because actually they do normally have images of the holy living creatures inside them, and they have a sort of almost proto image of the tree of life, because as you ascend through the spheres back to the outside world. So they and they have a sort of, most of them have a sort of baptistry at the bottom way that people get immersed in, and they did a double baptism of fire, of water and fire, because you'd be anointed with oil and blessed with fire as well. So it was quite a different. So this is there right at the beginning of Christianity, and then of course as Pauline Christianity appears, the Judaic roots kind of get lost really, because it gets taken away and made more Hellenistic, but oddly these figures are there right at the beginning and kind of and just continue all the way through.
This journey is like being reborn as in the crucifixion and arising.
That is exactly that. That descent. That's right. That's what we do. We descend into the deep. We give ourselves over. We are remade, and we return. We. It's where you had the birth imagery. We go into death. We go into the stillness. We let go of our normal sense of self. We're then remade, and we emerge as the new being to bless the world.
I read that there are still a couple, two or three ancient Anglo-Saxon churches in the country where you go down to the altar, the altar is a step down.
I think that's...
It's Bradford on Avon. It's near Stevens. Do you
have that? No, I don't know. I haven't been there too bad, but yes, that's a very ancient idea, and you find it in the Bible. You get it in Psalms. Out of the depth do I cry to thee, O Lord. So that literally, the idea is you descend, and so there has to be the descent into the earth, the descent into the body. And the early Jewish mystics, who are called the Merkabah riders, the riders of the chariot, then they ascend through the spheres, but they begin by descending into the chariot. So so this very old idea of you descend and then you ascend, which has got lost really in sort of a lot of the ascension traditions. There's no descent, so you actually separate yourself from the whole idea is you descend into intimacy with the living world, with the living flesh, and then together with the world soul, together with the world, you arise together into new life, into these more expanded spheres. So the whole universe is expanded with you. Well, that's the deep understanding of that then gets lost then in the traditions that deny the flesh and deny the beauty of the world. That's one of the problems of the Cathars in some ways, in that actually they just wanted to get away from here. And it's rather than embrace the body and embrace the world.
That's what a plant does, isn't it? The seed has to go down into the ground.
Yes.
Because when you were saying, oh, it's specifically human, I think, on the one hand.
Well, not just human.
I was just getting a picture of ragwort. Ragwort, because usually the grass is cut round, and it's just sort of growing like a And that is the tree of life that is coming from under the ground, and it is joining both together and taking in, and the whole. It's very photosynthesis, nothing of it. You know what I mean?
That is literally the tree of life. If we study things like plants, you can just see that move. Some of those movements are just absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's not just a human thing. The root goes down, and then the energy rises up. And if it's not properly rooted, of course, it can plants fall over, plants die.
It's quite a different experience. In Glastonbury Abbey, when you may attend a service or worship in the crypt underneath the Mary Chapel, or you may simply go there and meditate. It's quite a different experience to meditating on the surface of the earth.
Yeah.
The same if you ever go into Abbey House.
Oh, the downstairs chapel.
Steps, and that crypt there is a totally different experience to the meditation chapel on the ground floor.
Mm.
It's like utterly different approaches.
Yeah, that's also always been my experience. I've always loved both those places. They're two of the most powerful places for me in Glastonbury, because you go down into the earth. And certainly that crypt chapel in the Abbey's got an extraordinary presence, really, that you just don't find in the above ground places. It's very true.
That crypt was one of the last bits of major work that happened, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah,
very late, isn't it?
But interestingly, although it's quite late, because they're creating something that's very ancient. This idea of, you know, the chapel under the ground. You know,
well, it's created by what's his name? You know, that the famous.
Watching.
No, the one before him.
Beer.
Who journeyed abroad a lot, didn't he?
Yeah.
So would have brought back a lot of ancient knowledge from.
Yeah, I wonder.
Interesting. Mm. Also interesting the idea that Celtic festivals, you know, starting the night before, was like fortnight, you're incubating something.
You begin in the night. You begin in the night. That's part of the whole idea. Let's have a brief cup of tea, and then we'll just do a